Daisy said to her, "Bateman is here, and says he is alive and well, and is in such a good place, he would not come home for anything. He says he is learning how to be good." Mrs. B. then said, "Ask him if he has seen his father." Daisy replied, "He says he has not, he is not here, and says to you, 'Mother, don't fret about me, it is better I did not grow up.'" This communication set the mother to thinking, and she became a firm believer in a future state. The following morning, when alone with Daisy, Mrs. W., who had brought Mrs. B. to see her, asked Daisy how she could think Mrs. B.'s son was happy. "For," said she, "when he was here, you know he was such a bad boy. Don't you remember how he used to swear, and steal your playthings, and break them up? You know we did not allow him to play with you nor with my children, because he was so bad." Daisy replied, "Oh, Auntie, don't you know he never went to Sunday school, and was always hearing so much swearing? God knows he did not have half a chance." The same day her Sunday school teacher Mrs. H., who also was with her a great deal, was sitting beside her, when Daisy said to her, "Your two children are here." Now, these children had gone to the other life several years before, and if they had lived in this world would have been nearly grown up. Daisy had never heard anyone speak of them, nor did the mother have any pictures of them, so she could not have known anything whatever about them before seeing them in the spiritual world. When asked to describe them, her description of them as full grown did not agree with the mother's idea of them, so she said, "How can that be? They were children when they died." Daisy answered, "Allah says, children do not stay children, they grow up as they do in this life." Mrs. H. then said, "But my little daughter Mary fell, and was so injured that she could not stand straight." To this Daisy replied, "She is all right now, she is straight and beautiful, and your son is looking so noble and happy." Once she said, "Oh, Papa, do you hear that? It is the singing of the angels. Why, you ought to hear it, for the room is full of it, and I can see them, there are so many, I can see them miles and miles away." Mrs. W., already mentioned, who had lost her father a short time previous, wanted to know if Daisy had seen him, and brought his picture to let her see if she could recognize him. But in the evening, when she came again, Daisy told her she had not seen him, and that Allie, whom she had asked about him, had not seen him, but that Allie had said he would ask someone who could tell him about him. In a moment Daisy said, "Allie is here and says, 'Tell Auntie her father wants her to meet him in heaven, for he is there.'" Mrs. W. then said, "Daisy, why did not Allie know at once about my father?" "Because," replied she, "those who die go into different states or places and do not see each other at all times, but all the good are in the state of the blessed." During those last days of illness, Daisy loved to listen to her sister Lulu as she sang for her, mostly from the Sunday school songbook. Lulu sang one song, the chorus of which was, "Oh, come angel band, come and around me stand, oh, bear me away on your snowy wings, to my immortal home." When she had finished, Daisy exclaimed, "Oh, Lulu, is it not strange? We always thought the angels had wings. But it is a mistake, they don't have any." Lulu replied, "But they must have wings, else how do they fly down from heaven?" "Oh, but they don't fly," she answered, "they just come. When I think of Ali, he is here." Once I inquired, "How do you see the angels?" She replied, "I do not see them all the time, but when I do, the walls seem to go away, and I can see ever so far, and you couldn't begin to count the people. Some are near, and I know them, others I have never seen before." She mentioned the name of Mary C., the sister of Mrs. S., who was a neighbor of ours in Nevada City, and said, "You know she had such a bad cough, but she is well now, and so beautiful, and she is smiling to me." I was then sitting beside her bedside, her hand clasped in mine. Looking up so wistfully to me, she said, "Dear Mama, I do wish you could see Ali, he is standing beside you." Involuntarily I looked round, But Daisy thereupon continued, he says you cannot see him because your spirit eyes are closed, but that I can, because my body only holds my spirit, as it were, by a thread of life. I then inquired, does he say that now? Yes, just now, she answered. Then wondering how she could be conversing with her brother when I saw not the least sign of conversation, I said, Daisy, how do you speak to Ali? I do not hear you or see your lips move, she smilingly replied, we just talk with our think. I then asked her further, Daisy, how does Ali appear to you? Does he seem to wear clothes? She answered, oh, no, not clothes such as we wear. There seems to be about him a white, beautiful something, so fine and thin and glistening, and oh, so white, and yet there is not a fold, or a sign of a thread in it, so it cannot be cloth, but makes him look so lovely. Her father then quoted from the psalmist, he is clothed with light as a garment. Oh, yes, that's it, she replied. She often spoke of dying, and seemed to have such a vivid sense of her future life and happiness that the dread of death was all dispelled. The mystery of the soul's departure was to her no more a mystery. It was only a continuation of life, a growing up from the conditions of earth life into the air and sunshine of heaven. The morning of the day she died, she asked me to let her have a small mirror. I hesitated, thinking the sight of her emaciated face would be a shock to her. But her father, sitting by her, remarked, let her look at her poor little face if she wants to. So I gave it to her. Taking the glass in her two hands, she looked at her image for a time, calmly and sadly. At length, she said, this body of mine is about worn out. It is like that old dress of Mama's hanging there in the closet. She doesn't wear it anymore, and I won't wear my body anymore, because I have a new spiritual body which will take its place. Indeed, I have it now, for it is with my spiritual eyes I see the heavenly world while my body is still here. You will lay my body in the grave because I will not need it again. It was made for my life here, and now my life here is at an end, and this poor body will be laid away, and I shall have a beautiful body like Ali's. Then she said to me, Mama, open the shutters and let me look out at the world for the last time. Before another morning I shall be gone. As I obeyed her loving request, she said to her father, raise me up, Papa. Then, supported by her father, she looked through the window whose shutters I had opened, and called out, goodbye, sky. Goodbye, trees. Goodbye, flowers. Goodbye, white rose. Goodbye, red rose. Goodbye, beautiful world, and added, how I love it, but I do not wish to stay. That evening, when it was 8:30, she herself observed the time, and remarked, it is 8:30 now, when it is 11:30 Ali will come for me. She was then, for the time being, reclining on her father's breast, with her head upon his shoulder. This was a favorite position, as it rested her. She said, Papa, I want to die here. When the time comes, I will tell you. Lulu had been singing for her, and as 8:30 was Lulu's bedtime she arose to go. Bending over Daisy, as she always did, she kissed her, and said, good night. Daisy put up her hand and, stroking tenderly her sister's face, said to her, good night. When Lulu was halfway up the stairs, Daisy again called out after her, in a clear, sweet, earnest tone, good night and goodbye, my sweet, darling Lulu. At about 11:15 she said, now, Papa, take me up, Ali has come for me. After her father had taken her, she asked us to sing. Presently someone said, call Lulu, but Daisy answered promptly, don't disturb her, she is asleep. And then, just as the hands of the clock pointed to the 11:30, the time she had predicted that Ali was to come to take her with him, she lifted up both arms and said, come, Ali, and breathed no more. Then tenderly laying her loved but lifeless form upon the pillow, her father said, the dear child has gone, and added, she will suffer no more. There are one or two specially interesting points about this case, like case I in chapter 2. The dying child kept a consciousness of the visions which came to her, together with clear recognition of her earthly friends, and ability to converse with them sensibly. With Daisy Dryden the double consciousness lasted a few days, whereas in the case of Mrs. B, it only lasted an hour or two. Again the descriptions Daisy gave of her vision evidently did not accord with her preconceived ideas of a spiritual world, yet it did not once occur to her to doubt the reality of what she was learning of a life apart from a material body in the possession of a spiritual body. In p. 118 of the Nurseries of Heaven, cp. 56 above, is the following statement made by her mother: although she was on the whole a good child, possessing ordinary good sense, yet in no way was she more remarkable than many other children. Her dying experience, therefore, was not the outgrowth of a life highly spiritual, nor was it one which had been educated in the least degree on the lines of mysticism or modern spiritualism. Her father was so deeply impressed by what she most undoubtedly said, heard and revealed to them, that he began a careful study of the New Testament in the original Greek, and published a series of articles later on the subject. The following incident, taken from the American SPR Journal for 1918, volume 12, p. 623, was reported by Dr. E. H. Pratt, of Chicago: my sister Hattie, while attending school at Mount Carroll Seminary, suffered an attack of malignant diphtheria. She was brought home to be under our father's care, but he was unable to save her, and after a few days of extreme suffering her spirit took its flight into what seems to most of us such a dark, impenetrable expanse of appalling immensity. A deathbed scene occurred, so wonderful, realistic, and impressive, that although I was but 10 years of age at the time, my memory picture of that event is as vivid and distinct as though it were taken but yesterday. Her bed was in the middle of the living room, and my mother, father, younger sister, and a few friends were standing about it, gazing earnestly upon my sister's dear features, as the light of life gradually went out, and the ashy pallor of death settled over them. Hattie's going out was not abrupt. It was a gradual fading away, very calm and apparently free from pain. Although her throat was so choked up with diphtheritic membrane that her voice was very thick, and it required close attention to catch all of her words, her mind seemed unusually clear and rational. She knew she was passing away, and was telling our mother how to dispose of her little personal belongings among her close friends and playmates, when she suddenly raised her eyes as though gazing at the ceiling toward the farther side of the room, and after looking steadily and apparently listening for a short time, slightly bowed her head, and said, "Yes, Grandma, I am coming, only wait just a little while, please." Our father asked her, "Hattie, do you see your grandma?" Seemingly surprised at the question, she promptly answered, "Yes, Papa, can't you see her? She is right there waiting for me." At the same time she pointed toward the ceiling in the direction in which she had been gazing. Again addressing the vision she evidently had of her grandmother, she scowled a little impatiently and said, "Yes, Grandma, I'm coming, but wait a minute, please." She then turned once more to her mother, and finished telling her what of her personal treasures to give to different ones of her acquaintances. At last giving her attention once more to her grandma, who was apparently urging her to come at once, she bade each of us goodbye. Her voice was very feeble and faint, but the look in her eyes as she glanced briefly at each one of us was as lifelike and intelligent as it could be. She then fixed her eyes steadily on her vision but so faintly that we could but just catch her words, said, "Yes, Grandma, I'm coming now." Then without a struggle or evidence of pain of any kind she gazed steadily in the direction she had pointed out to us where she saw her grandma, until the absence of oxygen in her bloodstream, because respiration had ceased, left her hands and face all covered with the pallor of lifeless flesh. She was so clear-headed, so positive of the vision and presence of her grandma, with whom she talked so naturally, so surprised that the rest of us could not see grandma. The alternation of her attention and conversation between her grandma and father and mother were so distinctly photographed upon the camera of my brain that I have never since been able to question the evidence of the continuance of distinct recognizable life after death. Her grandmother had died a few years previously, and before that she and Grandma had always been such close friends, and the recognition of each other as Hattie left her body to join her dearly beloved Grandma in the realms beyond the vision of our physical eyes was so unquestionable and complete in every detail that it seems impossible to account for the remarkable event on any theory except that her Grandma was alive and so completely like herself while on Earth that Hattie's recognition of her was instantaneous and unquestionable, a real genuine experience. The following case was communicated to the American SPR by Mr. S.B. Bennett, see American SPR Journal for 1918, Volume 12, p. 607, Pittston, PA, December 15, 1906. Mr. G.H. Tench died in 1902, after years of patient though intense suffering of cancer. He lived in Wilkes-Barre, but was formerly a near neighbor of mine in West Pittston. During a portion of the time he was a foreman under me, enjoying mutual confidence and esteem. He received deserved promotion by another colco, but our personal relation remained the same. During the last weeks I watched with him as often as I could, going back and forth by rail. While suffering intensely he would not take narcotics nor stimulating medicine, saying, "I have lived all tension and I am going to die that way." The night the end came he roused his younger son, telling him to call the family as he was going away. He talked entirely rationally to them and was fully conscious. Later a brother came to the house and upon entering the room G.H. Tench said, "Goodbye, Will, I am going soon," and closed his eyes. The family thought the end had come, but after a short interval he opened his eyes and, looking over and above the bed foot, with raised head and every appearance of interest, said clearly and distinctly, "Why, they're all plain people." This closed the scene, which was described to me by his wife soon after the funeral. Now Tench was not a religious man, although attended by a Methodist minister at the last, but a moral, upright man in every relation of life, thoroughly courageous, as was shown by his refusal to have his sensibilities dulled in his suffering. Not highly educated, nor a great reader, yet I have no doubt he had thought about conditions he had to face, and was likely to have imbibed the wings and harp idea. Is it not possible that he at the last expressed surprise that the people waiting for him should be all plain people? I give you this as a fact. Signed, S. B. Bennett. The following narrative was recorded in the Journal of the American Society for Psychical Research, 1918, p. 603, having been sent to Professor Hislop by Mr. Ud. C. Gitterman, a member of the English SPR. He writes as follows: "My father died in Germany on March 18, 1892, and my mother then came to live with us at Odessa. Shortly after she fell ill, and died on May 6th of the following year, 1893. Both she and my father had always been most skeptical of anything concerning the existence and survival of the soul. A few minutes before her death she regained consciousness, having been in a state of coma for 2 hours previously, raised herself in her bed, stretched out her arms, and with a happy smile on her face, cried out, 'Papa, Papa,' just as if she suddenly saw him in front of her. Immediately after she fell back into the arms of my wife, and expired. My mother used to call her husband Papa, just as we children did. I certify that this is a perfectly true account of what took place." Signed, Rudd. C. Gitterman. The following abridged account of the last days of the American poet, Horace Strobel, is taken from a fuller narrative in the American SPR Journal for 1921, Volume 15, pp. 114-123. Horace Strobel, 1858-1919, was the Boswell of Walt Whitman. He was also author of a number of volumes of poems of the Whitman type, which some of his own disciples regard as equaling those of his master. He was also the founder of the well-known Contemporary Club of Philadelphia. The abridged account was contributed by Mrs. Flora MacDonald Dennison, who was present at the deathbed, to the April-May issue of a magazine entitled, The Sunset of Bon Echo, as follows: All day on August 28, Horace was very low-spirited. Anne's illness and the going of the Baines was too much for him. Mildred was with him a good deal and we decided not to leave him a minute. He had been brought in from the veranda but absolutely radiant, and on seeing me, he called out, "Look, look, Flora, quick, quick, he is going." "What, Horace?" I said, "what do you see?" "I cannot see anyone." "Why, just over the rock Walt appeared, head and shoulders and hat on in a golden glory, brilliant and splendid. He reassured me, beckoned to me, and spoke to me. I heard his voice but did not understand all. He said, "only come on." Frank Bain soon came in and he repeated the story to him. All the rest of the evening Horace was uplifted and happy. So often Horace would say, "do not despise me for my weakness," but now he was quite confident, even jocular, as I handed him a drink. On the night of September 3, Horace was very low. I stayed for a few hours with him. Once his eyes rolled, I thought he was dying, but he just wanted me to turn him. As I did so, he listened and seemed to hear something. Then he said, "I hear Walt's voice, he is talking to me." I said, "what does he say?" He said, "Walt says, come on, come on." After a time he said, "Flora, I see them all about me. Bob and Buck and Walt and the rest." Colonel Cosgrave had been with Horace in the afternoon and had seen Walt on the opposite side of the bed, and felt his presence. Then Walt passed through the bed and touched the colonel's hand, which was in his pocket. The contact was like an electric shock. Horace was also aware of Walt's visible presence and said so. There was no gloom about the house. No one seemed depressed. A feeling of triumph, of pride, and of exultation permeated the atmosphere. A letter was afterwards received by Mr. Walter Prince of the American S.P.R., from Col. Cosgrave, confirming the statement given by Mrs. Flora Denison as above. There are several cases of which records have been preserved in the Proceedings of the Society for Psychical Research and elsewhere, in which an account is given of those watching beside a dying relative having had a vision of spirit forms near the bed. In one case, two women watching by their dying sister, Charlotte, saw a bright light and within it two young faces hovering over the bed, gazing intently at Charlotte. The elder sister recognized these faces as being two of her brothers, William and John, who had died when she was young. The two sisters continued to watch the faces till they gradually faded away like a washed-out picture, and shortly afterwards their sister Charlotte died. Mr. Podmore, who investigated this case, remarks that it is possible the vision was due to a telepathic impact from the dying person, but this explanation is less tenable and quite as unlikely as is the percipience of spirit forms by the dying person and sometimes by those present. Mr. Podmore, with his usual prejudice against any supernormal explanation, remarks on this that the image is traditionally associated with death receiver sensory embodiment, but this point of view is not appropriate to the two following cases where the percipients, being very young children, could hardly be supposed to have any mental images traditionally associated with death, nor does it account for the collective hallucination described in Miss Pearson's case. This case is quoted by Stainton Moses. Miss H., the daughter of an English clergyman, was tending a dying child. His little brother, aged 3 to 4 years, was in a bed in the same room. As the former was dying, the little brother woke up, and, pointing to the ceiling with every expression of joy, said, "Mother, look at the beautiful ladies round my brother. How lovely they are. They want to take him." The child died at that moment. Another instance is reported by M. Pelluzzi, librarian at the Victor Emmanuel Library at Rome. A little girl of 3, Hippolyte Notari, partly paralyzed, was in the same room with her little brother of 4 months, who was dying. The father, the mother, and the grandmother of the two children were present. About 15 minutes before the death of the infant, little Hippolyte stretched out her arms, saying, "Look, mother, Aunt Olga." This Aunt Olga was a younger sister of M. Notari, who had killed herself a year previously owing to a disappointment in love. The parents asked, "Where do you see Aunt Olga?" The child said, "There, there." and tried insistently to get out of bed to go to her aunt. They let her get up. She ran to an empty chair and was much discountenanced because their vision had moved to another part of the room. The child turned round and said, pointing to a corner, "Aunt Olga is there." Then she became quiet and the baby died. In the following case, which was communicated by Professor W. C. Crosby, Associate Member, Society for Psychical Research, Proceedings SPR, Volume 8, pp. 229-231, the vision was seen by the nurse during the unconsciousness of the dying patient. The phantom seen was unknown to the percipient. Mrs. Caroline Rogers, 72 years old, a widow who had been twice married, and whose first husband, a Mr. Tisdale, died about 35 years ago, has lived on Ashland Street, in Roslindale, Mass, for the last 25 years, and since the death of her last child some years ago she has lived quite alone. Early in March of this year she was stricken with paralysis, and after an illness of nearly 6 weeks died on the afternoon of Tuesday, April 15. Mrs. Mary Wilson, a professional nurse, 45 years old, attended Mrs. Rogers during her illness, remaining with her almost constantly until she died. She had never seen Mrs. Rogers before the latter's illness, and knew nothing of her family or history. Mrs. Rogers spoke frequently to Mrs. Wilson, and also to others, as had long been her custom, of her second husband, Mr. Rogers, and children, expressing a desire to see them again, etc. On the afternoon of April 14, Mrs. Rogers became unconscious, and remained so all the time until her death 24 hours later. Mrs. Wilson sat up with her through the whole of Monday night. Mrs. Wilson's daughter Ryder, 25 years old, kept her mother company, and a boy of 10 or 12 years slept in an adjoining chamber, to be called in case of an emergency. These four were the only persons in the house. The outer doors were securely locked. The door leading from the sick chamber on the second floor into the hall was kept locked all the time because it was near the foot of Mrs. Rogers' bed, and entrance to the sick chamber was gained by passing from the upper hall into the living room by a door which was locked that night, and thence through the chamber in which the boy slept, the two chambers having been made to communicate by cutting a door through the back of a small closet. This door was diagonally facing the bed on which Mrs. Rogers lay. Mrs. Wilson rested on a settee placed at right angles to the head of Mrs. R.'s bed, so that when lying down her face was almost directly opposite this door and not more than 10 or 12 feet from it. The lamp, which burned brightly all night, stood on a small table in the corner of the room directly opposite the door, and Ida occupied a couch against the wall and between the lamp and door. Mrs. Wilson was pretty well worn out with her long vigil. Believing that Mrs. Rogers was dying, she was naturally very nervous and timid, and having heard Mrs. R. speak frequently of seeing her departed friends, etc., she had a feeling of expectancy and dread with regard to supernatural visitations. Between 2 and 3 a.m., while her daughter was asleep, and while she was resting on the settee, but wide awake, she happened to look toward the door into the adjoining chamber and saw a man standing exactly in the doorway, the door being kept open all the time. He was middle-sized, broad-shouldered, with shoulders thrown back, had a florid complexion, reddish-brown hair, bare-headed, and beard, and wore a brown sack overcoat, which was unbuttoned. His expression was grave, neither stern nor pleasant, and he seemed to look straight at Mrs. Wilson, and then at Mrs. Rogers without moving. Mrs. Wilson supposed, of course, that it was a real man, tried to think how he could have got into the house. Then, as he remained quite motionless, she began to realize that it was something uncanny, and becoming frightened, turned her head away and called her daughter, who was still asleep on the couch, awakening her. On looking back at the door after an interval of a minute or two, the apparition had disappeared. Both its coming and going were noiseless, and Mrs. Rogers remained perfectly quiet, and so far as could be known entirely unconscious during this time. The chamber into which this door leads being quite dark, there was no opportunity to observe whether or not the apparition was transparent. Mrs. Wilson shortly afterwards went into this chamber and the living room, but did not examine the lower part of the house until morning, when the doors were found properly locked and everything all right.